Right, I reckon we can make a start. So, last week I did several things. I talked about Hobbes's problem, the problem of violence, the explanatory and practical problem of violence. Explanatory problem being, given that no one wants violence, why is it so common? And the practical problem being, what should we do about it? How should we prevent it? And I suggested that Hobbes's project, in response to that, double problem, was to end violence using science and persuasion. I talked a fair amount about what I slightly frivolously called the Lego method that Hobbes adopts, this method of understanding things by taking them to bits and then putting them back together in mind, if not in reality. And then I addressed the first part of that, of his putting that method into practice, his attempt to describe, understand human passion, human decision-making, the will, the good life, as matter in motion, to show how those things are built up from smaller physical parts. This week, I want to move on to the next stage of that Lego project. We've got the individual human parts for Leviathan. The next question is, how do they fit together? Or in fact, how do they fail to fit together? Hobbes' conclusion in this section of his argument is going to be that without Leviathan, without strong communal power and morality, artificial morality that power creates, human life is a disaster. As the famous quote goes, it's solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Left to themselves, left to nature, humans will make their own and each other's lives miserable. And that's then my main subject today. Hobbes' arguments for that conclusion. That is, his answer to the explanatory problem of violence. Why is violence so common? His answer is going to be because of the way that individual humans naturally fit together very badly. Before I get on to that main topic, though, I want to say a bit more about Hobbes' methods, and depending on how the time goes, I want to say something about selfishness as well. Important issue for Hobbes. First, though, method, a bit more on method. I said that Hobbes' methods are science and persuasion. And it may have struck you, certainly those of you who have come across Hobbes before or have read something about him, it was slightly peculiar that I didn't mention the social contract. Hobbes is known centrally as one of the founding fathers of the social contract tradition. So let me now make good that discrepancy and explain a bit why I didn't say that social contract was one of his methods last week, by sketching social contract theory in general, and then saying something about how Hobbes uses it. My sketch of social contract theory will be somewhat familiar to those of you who were in Phil 100 last year and therefore heard me lecturing on political philosophy. Now, you've heard some of this before, but you know, it's worth reminding you of it, and it's worth saying it to those people who haven't heard me do this before, since I have what may be a slightly eccentric take on social contract theory. So, social contract theory. The basic idea is the following story. Once upon a time, and I do mean the fairy tale implications of once upon a time. Once upon a time, humans lived without government, the state, without settled social institutions, without hierarchy, perhaps even without sociability, social feeling, perhaps even without morality. And then, because that state of nature, technical term, was, well, less than ideal, we decided to get together and jointly agree to set up government or the state or society or morality. Let's just say the state from now on, to a convenient term. In order to make things better. The state of nature wasn't so great, so we decided to get together and make something better. And the important normative point, because we all agreed to it, that state that we set up was right or justified. That is, was supported or endorsed by morality or reason or rationality. The fundamental contrast here is with an alternative origin story for the state or for those other institutions, which goes, once upon a time humans lived without the state and so on, and then a group of bandits got fed up. With riding from village to village, sleeping in tents, and just grabbing what they could carry away and running, and decided instead to settle down in one place. Yeah? You kill off the headman of the village, you settle down in his hut, you intimidate the people there into paying for protection. You've got a nice village here. It'd be a shame if anything happened to it. Could just catch fire. They started telling people what to do. They started threatening to punish them if they didn't do it. They started representing themselves as the rightful owners or leaders of the village, maybe as the representatives of the gods, and turned into the state. And, of course, here's the naughty point. Because that state was set up by force, threat, fraud, not by agreement, it wasn't justified, wasn't supported by morality or reason or rationality. That's the fundamental contrast here. We've got two origin stories where the difference between a justified state and an unjustified one is the difference between states that are set up by agreement and states that aren't or couldn't be. The state which was or could have been set up by mutual agreement between free and equal people is justified. The state which was or could only have been set up as a protection racket is not justified. So the fundamental thought is a thought about agreement, or about compelling reasons for agreement. Not all social contract theorists think that there has to be a literal moment of going, we agree. Some of them are concerned just to show the reasons for agreement. Particular social contract theories then vary in that way and in a whole range of other ways, but they do all share this fundamental three-part narrative structure. There is a depiction of a state of nature, a starting place, which lacks some major part of our current life, like government or morality or social organisation or secular institutions, which we want to investigate and perhaps critique, which we want to think about the reasons, the rationality of. Second element, an agreement of some kind. A moment which changes us from a people in the state of nature to a people in some other state, maybe the state, the government. Third, and importantly, an argument that what would be agreed to matters for us. That what there are reasons to agree to in the state of nature has some significance for what we ought to do, gives us a standard, creates more maturity for us, who after all aren't apparently in the state of nature, and probably never have been. And I don't remember ever being asked whether I agreed to be ruled by this government. Right? We need an argument to show that somehow that story is somehow relevant to us. How does that story tell us what's right and what's wrong? So there are the three major narrative elements, social contract stories. State of nature, agreement, and an argument that this is relevant to us. I'll mostly be talking about section one of that, part one of that, perhaps today. But we first have to ask ourselves, really the fundamental question, for social contract theories. What's the status of this narrative? I've already hinted at this. Is it supposed to be true? Is it supposed to be history? Is it supposed to be anthropology? When's this supposed to happen, if it is? Is the state of nature supposed to be the actual state of, say, primitive peoples in our past or in other countries? Is the central agreement supposed to be something that really has happened or really could happen, or is it some sort of hypothetical theoretical device? That's, I think, perhaps the central question over which different social contract theorists divide. So, for instance, Hobbes's near contemporary John Locke answers, yes, this is real. The state of nature is a real way humans can and have lived together. They lived together here in England at some point in the past, in that way. Locke thinks, in fact, that the Native Americans of his own time were still in the state of nature, although, you know, his information was pretty patchy, but he thought it was really going on. And he thinks that legitimation of government requires real agreement here and now, requires us actually to agree, although the agreement doesn't have to be explicit, it can be tacit. You can signal your agreement merely by not moving out. That'll do, but it does have to be a real agreement. And in this way, he's a huge influence, for instance, on the American Constitution, which does originally claim that the government has to be re-endorsed by the people every generation. Not that they've done that for a while. For the 20th century social contract theorist, in contrast, John Rawls, in contrast, this is definitely not real. Absolutely not. Rawls's equivalent of the state of nature, the original position, is not at all intended to be a description of anything real. It's a thought experiment. It's a dramatisation that helps us uncover and organise our intuitions about fairness, and that's all it is. And it's no worse for that, because he's completely explicit that that's what he's doing. He's not trying to trick you in any way. It's just a thought experiment. It's definitely hypothetical. Hobbes, though, Hobbes is ambiguous here. He's deeply ambiguous about what the status of this whole story, the social contract story, is supposed to be. Is it real, or is it a hypothetical device? There are reasons for taking both sides of that dispute. Is it a historical or anthropological claim? Well, Hobbes's problem, as I presented it last week, is the real immediate historical problem of violence. It's not a work, not just a work of armchair theory. The problem is real, real violence. People killing one another. And in answering to it, Hobbes does in fact appeal to history and to people's experience. Chapter 13 of Leviathan, which I'll be spending quite a lot of time on later in this lecture, tries to describe general features of the human psyche and of human interaction, which Hobbes thinks you will recognise from real life as things that are actually real and that actually happen. On the other hand, reasons to think that Hobbes's use of the social contract story is just a theoretical or analytic device. Hobbes distinguishes very strongly between science, scientific theory, on the one hand, and prudence, derived from experience, on the other. We talked about this in some of the seminars last week, not all. Science gives certain conclusions by deduction. Prudence is just a gradual adding up of experience in your memory and merely gives us probabilities. And Hobbes is ambitious. He does not want just to give you prudent advice. He doesn't want to just give you probabilities. He wants certain demonstration of his conclusions. He wants to produce moral political science. And his model for science is geometry. It's not natural science. It's maths. He calls geometry the only science that it hath pleased God hitherto to bestow on mankind, in chapter 4. And he thinks that the method of geometry is the resolutive compositive method, which I've so far described in terms of this analogy with Lego, dismantling things and putting them back together again. But really what geometers do is not dismantling anything, it's analysing things into their logical components and explaining holes as deductions of the properties of those components. Starting from a definition of a straight line, working up to definitions of angles, triangles, the angles of triangles, the relationships between the angles and side lengths of triangles, and so on. It's an analytic model of geometry, not a historical one. And, just to make the point a bit more that it might be analytic and theoretical, not actual, real real actual agreement doesn't do very much work for Hobbes in his account of morality. It's very important for Locke, real agreement. But Hobbes, he's much more interested in making clear the overwhelming reasons for agreement, in showing that agreement is rational. He doesn't really mind whether you actually say, I agree or not. What he's interested in doing is making clear the reasons why you should, why you're making a mistake if you don't. So there are reasons on both sides. I think that ambiguity in the social contract is a main reason why Hobbes tells a social contract story. It suits both of his main methods. Suits his scientific ambitions and his ambition to persuade, not just to be an armchair theorist, but to have Leviathan read in the pulpit. Yeah? To get people on side. Social contract, this idea of explaining society and justifying particular forms of society as agreement out of a world where there are just individuals, it's a dramatization of understanding things by analyzing them into their component parts. The Lego method, putting them back together. But also, the social contract story is a compelling story. It's dramatic. And humans like stories better than they like geometric proofs on the whole. Yeah. Hobbes wants to do science, but he wants his science to persuade. And the story, the social contract story, neatly connects those. It puts a persuasive gloss on the science. Although perhaps at the cost of making the proof rather less clear. The social contract in general suits Hobbes' ambitions, I thought. He wants Leviathan to persuade as many people as possible. So he's an opportunist about what he appeals to. He'll appeal to anything he thinks will get the audience on side. He'll appeal to science, which is his only preferred method of proceeding. He is, after all, when he's not writing polemical political works like Leviathan, a working scientist. He'll appeal to science. He'll also appeal to the audience's experience, to your liking for stories, to your tendency to go along with a good driving narrative. He'll appeal to your experience of human nature. He'll appeal to your immediate knowledge of history. In parts 3 and 4 of Leviathan, which we won't really be looking at, he'll appeal to belief in the Bible. He reckons that a good proportion of his audience will be convinced if he can show them that the Bible supports Hobbes' position. So he spends a great deal of time carefully re-deriving his conclusions from biblical exegesis, and jumps through an amazing range of hoops to do it as well. He must have worked very hard to pull this together. He'll appeal to anything. Anything he thinks will convince you. Science, stories, history, experience, the Bible. Whatever might get you on side. But that opportunism does mean that he's often really problematically ambiguous about what exactly he's doing when. What exact work the social contract story is supposed to do, which parts of it are science, which parts of it are appeals to experience. Because those two parts often don't fit together very well. Sometimes they seem to pull in different directions. And I think that double use of social contract storytelling, both for science and as persuasion, I think that partly accounts for the huge range of interpretations of Hobbes' arguments. People pick out different sides of it. You get people on the one hand like Don Herzog in his Ace book, Happy Slaves. He reads Leviathan as pessimistic moralising based on bitter experience of fallen humankind. On the other hand, you get people like David Gautier who reads Leviathan as a logical deduction and uses the modern tools of game theory, rational choice theory, to explicate it. But I think both of them are onto something, but both of them are missing something as well. My reading is somewhere in the middle. I'll suggest what I think, how I think it works, in a minute. But yeah, given how time is going, I'm going to say a bit about selfishness first. This kind of came up a bit in some of the seminars, so I just wanted to make a point about this. And also, it comes up a lot in Hobbes' interpretations. It's worth your knowing about it. So, that was more on method and the social contract. Now I'm going to talk about selfishness for a bit as an aside, because I think it's useful. And then I'm going to spend the rest of the lecture setting out what I think is Hobbes' argument in chapter 13 of Leviathan for his conclusion that the state of nature is disastrous. This is central section. Selfishness. Let me first do some ground clearing. I have discovered in a few years of giving versions of this course that when I talk about selfishness and when we talk about Hobbes's apparent claims about selfishness, there is a thing people often say, which I think is a red herring, and we need to clear up. People often appeal to the idea of the selfish gene. Obviously derived from Richard Dawkins' best-selling book of that title. Let me just say a bit about that, about why I think people should be more careful about how they appeal to the selfish gene and why I don't think it's actually very relevant here. First, obvious point, surprisingly not noticed by too many people who use the notion, genes are not literally selfish. Really basic, but have to say it to be clear. A gene is a sequence of amino acids on a chromosome with a control function in how phenotypes are built in wombs and their equivalents. It doesn't have plans, it doesn't have a sense of self, doesn't distinguish itself from other genes. Yeah, it's just a sequence of amino acids. It can't be literally selfish. So it's a metaphor. Obviously it's a metaphor, the selfish gene, but it's a metaphor that's burst its banks, as they so often do. It gets used in ways that Dawkins never intended, and which perhaps he didn't guard against sufficiently carefully, at least in earlier editions of the selfish gene. He's much more careful in later editions to try and be really explicit about this. Dawkins' point about the selfish gene is that we can explain the nature of living things as strategies for reproducing the genes that build those things. Genes are selfish only in the sense that what they try to do is ensure the maximize the number of copies of themselves in the next generation. They are not trying to benefit the organism they're part of, although that is often the unintended consequence. They're not trying to benefit the species. All they're trying to do is maximize the number of copies of the next generation of themselves. The point is that natural selection takes place at the level of individual genes, not at the level of the organism, not at the level of populations. That's the claim. It's the gene's eye view of evolution. Yeah? Evolutionary change does not necessarily benefit organisms, nor does it necessarily benefit populations or species. That's the point. Here's the important reason why I don't think selfish gene theory, although very interesting, is relevant for questions we want to ask about human selfishness, which Hobbes engages with. The fact, if it is one, that genes are selfish in that sense, tells us nothing at all about selfishness or otherwise the kinds of creatures those genes build. It doesn't tell us anything about what strategies are best for making biological robots, for making more copies of genes are. There are lots of different strategies, and which is successful depends on the environment. The common confusion is that selfish genes have to make selfish organisms. It doesn't follow. Selfish genes don't tell us that humans are naturally selfish. They have no relevance to that question. Because there are lots of different tactics for maximising gene reproduction. Sharks, well, their gene line seems to have settled on selfish tactics. Sharks don't much care about other sharks, it seems. Humans, well, our gene line has settled on other different tactics. Yeah? Plainly, we're not wholly selfish. We're not wholly altruistic either, but we do have limited altruism. That's just an obvious observation. Human individuals care about people who are not themselves, especially their children. You will have seen in the media, of course, that three people have just died trying to save their children. And that's not weird. That's normal human And it's not selfish in any normal or literal sense of that term to die saving your children. It's obviously altruistic in the literal sense of that term. So, the point I'm getting at is, metaphorically selfish genes can and do build literally altruistic creatures like us. So the idea of the selfish gene is not relevant to questions about how selfish humans are. That's an open question to be resolved in other ways. If you want to pursue this, I think, very interesting issue further, the place to look, obviously, is Dawkins' own book, The Selfish Gene. I also recommend Brian Garvey of the department here has just published a book called The Philosophy of Biology, which has a very good chapter on the selfish gene. So I recommend that if you want to pursue it. That's ground clearing. Let's leave that to one side. Let's not get into that argument in the seminars about selfish genes. There is an argument to get into, though, about selfishness and Hobbes. And it's this one. Many people represent Hobbes as being what's known as a psychological egoist, someone who believes that humans are totally selfish. Each individual acts only for her own sake. Apparently, altruistic acts are always disguised selfishness. So, for instance, I may give to charity, but actually, I'm only doing that because it makes me feel good about myself, or because I hope other people will notice and think well of me, say. That thought believes relevant. The thought that there is no real altruism in the world, that everyone only acts for their own sake. There are reasons for thinking that Hobbes holds that position. For instance, in chapter 14, he says, of the voluntary acts of every man, the object is some good to himself. Also, for instance, there's a famous story in Aubrey's biography of Hobbes about Hobbes and the beggar. One time, I remember, going in the Strand, a poor and infirm old man craved his alms. He, beholding him with eyes of pity and compassion, put his hand in his pocket and gave him sixpence, a not inconsiderable sum at the time. So, said a divine that stood by, would you have done this if it had not been Christ's command? Yea, said he. Why, quoth the other. Because, said Hobbes, I was in pain to consider the miserable condition of the old man, and now my alms, giving him some relief, doth also ease me. Hobbes is trying to explain his own charitable impulse on the basis that, well, I felt bad seeing him in such a bad place. Now I feel better. I was motivated by my own good. So there's good reason to think that Hobbes does hold this extreme position, this extremely implausible position, let's point out. I think there are better reasons for thinking that he doesn't hold that position. He's not a psychological egoist, although he is deeply cynical. The first reason for thinking he's not a psychological egoist is that remark from chapter 14, of the voluntary acts of every man, the object is some good to himself. That's a tautology. It's true by definition, given what Hobbes means by good. That has to be true, given what voluntary action is. It's action based on your own will. And what good is the object of your desire. What's the will? It's your desire. It's a tautology. It's deliberately true by definition. It doesn't tell us anything about the content of desires. It just tells us something about how motivation works. It's just a theory of human action. The distinction here is between what role do desires in general play in producing human action, and what content do human desires have. Hobbes is only speaking to that first question. And we talked about the role that desires have in human action. That's the burden of his theory of the will, right? All human actions are just the result of whatever desire ends up on top in the backwards and forwards deliberation process. He doesn't say anything about what the content of those desires are. Might be anything. Might be anything at all. This is not a position, not a position known as egoism. It's a position technically known as internalism, which is a theory of motivation. All it says is all human actions are produced by the desires of the person who is acting. It's not a theory of the content of desires. The desire might be for
Sam gets rich and famous. It might just as equally be the hungry are fed and comforted. Both of those things are perfectly consistent with the internalist theory of desire. Of course, the second one isn't consistent with an egoist theory. So I don't think Hobbes is a psychological egoist, but his theory is not a matter of content in your desires. Selfishness is a matter of content. Selfish person, well, their desires are all about themselves, not about other people. But it should be accepted, Hobbes is extremely cynical about human motivation. He doesn't think all desires are selfish, but he thinks a heck of a lot of them are. And he thinks we do well to be suspicious of apparently altruistic desires. His particular example here is the Catholic Church, actually. This is towards the end of chapter 12 on religion. For who is it there that does not see to whose benefit it conduceth to have it believed that a king hath not his authority from Christ unless a bishop crown him? That a king, if he be a priest, cannot marry? That whether a prince be born in lawful marriage or not must be judged by authority from Rome? And so on. He gives a whole list of ways in which claims which are made by the Catholic Church as being matters of morality are just disguises for obviously self-interested policy. It is to the advantage of the Pope if we believe that a king hath not his authority unless he's crowned by a bishop. So this is Hobbes being cynical and asking the lawyer's question. Cui bono? Who benefits? The answer in this case being Pope. So Hobbes is very cynical about particular claims to moral or altruistic motivation, but that doesn't mean he needs to claim that there is no such thing. Because if he was claiming there was no such thing, that piece of sarcastic unmasking would make no sense, right? It makes sense precisely because there's a distinction here between selfish acts and unselfish ones. So, okay, I've probably gone on about this enough. My view is that Hobbes is not a psychological egoist. He doesn't think that all humans are entirely egoistic. But he does think they're quite strongly egoistic, and he thinks you should be suspicious about altruism. But there is a fair amount of dispute about that freedom, I should say. If you want to pursue it, the place to start is Bernard Goethe's piece. Goethe is G-E-R-T in the Cambridge Companion to Hobbes, which is on the reading list in the further reading. So if you wanted to pursue that, that's where to go. Okay, so that's the end of my second section. I wanted just to make this point about selfishness because it's important for how we read Hobbes, and it will come back in towards the end. Let me now, though, in the time remaining, talk about chapter 13. This is one of the central chapters of Leviathan. It's one of the most important chapters. It's quite short. It's superficially quite clear. It creates an incredible amount of dispute about what exactly is going on. I think, as I've said, part of that dispute is just a result of the fact that Hobbes is trying to do several things at once and they don't totally go together. He's trying to be scientific and persuasive, trying to do moral geometry and tell a good story at the same time. And he therefore mixes up all sorts of sources of argument, experience, appeals to our knowledge of human nature as we develop it just by encountering other people, derivation, logical derivation from axioms. It's all mixed up here. You will need to read and reread this chapter to work out what you think about what's going on here. Let me, as a starting place for that, offer you what I think is going on here. I think the central pivot of this argument is in 13, paragraphs 6 to 7. I think this is where we ought to start, and everything else revolves around this. So that in the nature of man, we find three principal causes of quarrel. First, competition. Secondly, diffidence. And thirdly, glory. The first maketh men inveigh for gain. The second, for safety, and the third for reputation. The first use violence to make themselves masters of other men's persons, wives, children, and cattle. The second to defend them. The third for trifles, as a word, a smile, a different opinion, and any other sign of undervalue, either direct in their persons or by reflection in their kindred, their friends, their nation, their profession, or their name. There are three causes of quarrel in human nature. I've sometimes put this as saying there are three different kinds of people. I don't think that's quite right. There are three deeply rooted tendencies in human nature, and we all have all of them to some extent. How much varies? But we all have these. Three causes of quarrel: competition, diffidence, and glory. The first is that we desire what others have, and we're sometimes prepared to take what others have if we can by violence. We're sometimes prepared to snatch things off people if we can. That means we are in competition over the objects of desire. Another tendency is that we are afraid that we'll be unable to defend ourselves against the first tendency in others. That is, we're diffident. Diffidence, as Hobbes has defined it in chapter 6, is the opposite of confidence. It's a constant despair of our own lives and persons and property. We are always afraid that we won't be able to prevail if somebody does try to take something from us. And therefore, Hobbes makes quite a lot of this, and therefore we have reason to preempt later attack by getting the retaliation in first. If we have a good idea that somebody is going to be one of the snatching people, call them an invader, we have good reason to hit them hard now, while they're not prepared. And of course, it's often very difficult to tell who's going to be an invader. So the diffident person has reason to be suspicious of everyone. Has reason always to be thinking, are they getting a little too big for their boots? Shall I slap them down now? We always have reason to be thinking that because we're afraid. Third tendency, at least some of us think so much about what other people think of them that they're prepared to attack anyone who seems to be disrespecting. Hobbes is probably partly satirising the nobility here, their obsession with honour and name, and proper politeness in address. But, you know, enough of us just get offended and prepared to be violent in that way. Given those three tendencies and the absence of a power able to stop this kind of thing, there will be endemic violence. Invaders try to conquer their neighbours to take their stuff. Diffident people try to defend themselves and get the jump on potential invaders. And glory hounds run around the place saying, are you looking at my pint? Are you disrespecting me? Well, the state of nature, according to Hobbes, is a bit like kind of east-west, east-side, west-side hip-hop world. There's an awful lot of standoffs and staring. And that gets us to the conclusion that the state of nature is miserable. It's horrible. It's to be avoided at all costs. It's just too horrendous. That's the claim. There are these three causes of quarrel: competition, diffidence, and glory. And between them, in the absence of power to stop it, there will be a need for violence. The important question then is, where does Hobbes get these? How does he unearth these three features of human nature? What reason can he give us for thinking that he's right? After all, we might just deny this, or say, well, yes, there are those, but, you know, maybe they're not as bad as you think. Where does he get them? How does he support the claim? And here's where we get into this problem that there are both prudential storytelling elements and scientific geometrical elements at work here. He draws on both. There are both appeals, direct appeals to prudence, to your experience of human life, and there are derivations from earlier definitional and derivational work done that we talked about last week. So, in order of increasing complexity, I suggest, one, the desire for glory. This is just a direct appeal to experience. Hobbes is just asking us to look into our own hearts without self-deceit and admit that we do hate it when treat us with contempt. In the right circumstances, we might lash out at someone who did, Or even if you wouldn't, even if you're a peaceable guy, peaceable girl, you might well realise that other people aren't. Some people you know, are so hung up on what you think of them that they might be a threat to you if they feel themselves to be treated with contempt. You know, obviously this isn't Hobbes' example, but you know, there is a reason why when you're coming out of the pub late at night, you see that big group of lads in the highly flammable tracksuits, you feel nervous. Because you do think you could insult them without intending to. At least I do. Yeah. Maybe that's more a thing that happens to blokes. But you know you don't want to cast their eye in the wrong way. Right. This is Hobbes as pessimistic moralist, telling us ugly truths about human nature, about how people react to contempt, from his own wide experience. So that's just, the glory claim is just a claim from experience. It's not derived from anything much else he said, really. It's just a claim. Look into your own heart and see if I'm not right. Second claim, diffidence, the opposite of confidence. This is a derivation, but it's a derivation from a claim from experience. It's a derivation from a claim about equality. Hobbes thinks it's a basic fact of experience that humans are equal. This is another way in which he gets tangled up in the tradition of the social contract. It's a traditional assumption of social contract theory that humans are equal. And usually it's a moral assumption. For Locke, it's a feature of the state of nature that all humans are morally equal. They have equal rights to life, liberty, property, and to punish people who violate their rights. Hobbes is not making a moral claim. He's not saying that we ought to treat one another as equals. For Hobbes, equality is actually just a brute fact about human bodies. I don't mean minds, but especially bodies. This is the very first paragraph in chapter 13. Nature hath made men so equal in the faculties of body and mind as that, though there be found one man sometimes manifestly stronger in body or a quicker mind than another, yet when all is reckoned together, the difference between man and man is not so considerable as that one man can thereupon claim to himself any benefit to which another may not pretend as well as he. For, as to strength of body, the weakest has strength enough to kill the strongest, either by secret machination or by confederacy with others that are in the same danger with himself. No matter what small advantages of strength or wit or speed you enjoy over other individual humans, no one is strong or vigilant or clever enough always to resist conspiracy and coalition. This isn't moral egalitarianism. It's the egalitarianism of fear. The others can always gang up on you, and they know where you sleep. All they have to do is creep up in the middle of the night with a rock. Even the weakest have strength enough to kill the strongest. Nobody can be completely secure. Nobody can be completely free of fear of what others might do to them. Everyone's vulnerable. But the point here is, there are no superhumans. As it turns out, as an empirical fact, now, nobody has a skull such that you can't bash it in with a rock. So, everyone has reason to fear for their lives and goods. Everyone has reason to be diffident. And therefore, of course, to conspire against potential threats. This is a derivation, then, from equality to diffidence. Although Hobbes says you could also spot it in experience. If you're not afraid of what other people might do to your person and property, why do you lock your door at night? Direct empirical experience just to back it up. So far, it doesn't seem like all the stuff we talked about last week has done very much work here. It looks almost as though he could just have started with this argument on page one. I think actually it is already doing some negative work, all the stuff about materialist human nature, because it is saying there's nothing extra there to combat the effect of all these fears, these desires. There is no supervisory reason or will that can tell us, oh, it's not really worth worrying about what strangers think of you, whether they're looking at your pond funny. got that desire, you've got it. So there's some negative work being done here already, but where the materialist account of human nature really does work, I think, is in the third cause of quarrel, competition, which is a derivation. It's a derivation from earlier work. The derivation runs from Hobbes' account of desire and the good life, to an account of power, to the competition for goods.
Just have a look at the start of chapter 11. There we go.
Felicity, this should be familiar to us, this initial point. Felicity is a continual progress of the desire from one object to another, the attaining of the former being still but the way to the latter. The cause whereof is that the object of man's desire is not to enjoy once only, for one instant of time, but to assure forever the way of his future desire. And therefore the voluntary actions and inclinations of all men tend not only to the procuring, but also to the assuring of a contented life, and differ only in the way. So that, in the first place, I put for a general inclination of all mankind a perpetual and restless desire of power after power that ceaseth only in death. Life consists of perpetual desire, as we already know for Hobbes. The good life is the life of felicity, which is continual desire satisfaction. And, important addition, satisfactions are connected to one another in various complex ways. Yeah? Some of them are means to further satisfactions. I want X because it can allow me to get Y. It's a means. Or, I want Z because it will allow me to keep Y now that I've got it, to continue enjoying it. That is, it's a security or protection of the thing I want. Power is just a general name for those ways of getting or securing goods. This is just another Hobbesian definition. The power of a man, to take it universally, is his present means to obtain some future apparent good. Power is just a generic word for all the means for getting and securing. Therefore, I'll just read this out, I put it for a general inclination of all mankind, a perpetual and restless desire for power after power that ceaseth only in death. This follows directly from the definitions of good life and of power. Hobbes. Perpetual and restless desire for power after power. Desire is endless while we're alive, therefore, so is desire for the means to get what we desire and hold on to it, i.e. power. And therefore we'll continually clash over power. None of us can limit our desire for power. Even if we don't want more than we have, even if we're quite moderate in our desires, we still need security for what we've got, because someone else is going to want it for themselves. Note, there's a hidden premise in this derivation, which Hobbes barely mentions, but needs highlighting. It's the assumption of scarcity, in the economist's sense. There ain't enough goods for everyone to get everything they want. We need to build that in. And it's an empirical claim. Of course, it's a pretty plausible empirical claim, especially since Hobbes thinks that desires are limitless. There could be an awful lot of stuff, but it would still be scarce in that sense. Second note, and this is coming back to the idea of selfishness. Selfishness doesn't seem to play a role in this argument for competition. It's a derivation from the fact of unending desire, and therefore power after power, not from the content of desires. Important distinction I was making before. My desires might be entirely altruistic. I might desire only to make sure that all the hungry are fed. But I'll still get into competition with people who have different desires, who want to do different things for the same goods available. In fact, I'll even get into competition with people who just want to feed different people first. We could all have totally altruistic desires. We would still be able to derive power after power, and therefore competition, and therefore quarrel, and therefore war. Three causes of quarrel derived from human nature and discovered in human experience lead to the conclusion that the state of nature is a state of permanent war.
permanent violence. Although note, the state of war isn't necessarily a state of continuous battle. It's like Hobbes makes this lovely analogy with bad weather. The weather is bad not just if it's pouring with rain, but if there's a known disposition to pour with rain in 5 minutes. We're in a state of war not only if we're fighting now, but if we know that we might have to fight in 5 minutes. And that demonstrates the disastrous effects of being in the state of nature. Yeah? Life is nasty, poor, solitary, brutish, and short because of the continual threat, frequent occurrence of violent conflict between individuals and temporary coalitions ganging up if we couldn't threaten them. It's nasty because nobody can afford to risk wasting their time and effort on producing any of the things which make life more pleasant, like nice houses or even tilling the fields. Because people who did take that risk don't have as much time and effort available to defend themselves and therefore go under, conquered and perhaps killed or enslaved by invaders, or even more tragically, conquered and killed or enslaved by moderates who are just trying to defend themselves. They can't tell who's an invader or not, and if they see someone tilling the fields and getting more grain and therefore having a bigger family and being growing big strong sons, they just think, threat! Kick them now! Before any more of them turn up. Moderates are afraid. What you might do is you get a bit bigger and less hungry. So, the state of nature is a state of war. And Hobbes presents that as a necessary conclusion of facts about human nature. It's not a conclusion derived from selfishness. It's a conclusion derived from three causes of quarrel, grounded in our experience and our derivation of what humans are like. In the absence of communal power, things are going to be horrendous. I'll leave it on that note. Thanks, folks.